look, I figure that tonight I'll do the last show on the subject of Nigeria. It's a very, very funny thing I've noticed about this thing. We started to do these shows Monday. For those of you who don't know, I got back from Nigeria Monday night, and since that time I've been doing a few shows. It's been since Monday on the subject of Nigeria, and oddly enough, it's like I've unplugged a cork here or something, because I've suddenly been deluged. People have been writing letters and questions and stuff, and I'm not really working for the Chamber of Commerce of Nigeria. I have no vested interest on as far as the west coast of Africa is concerned, but I do realize now that hardly anybody knows anything about it. It's almost totally unknown to a large percentage of the American population, and as a matter of fact, the world population. I got into Germany the day that I was on my way back. I stopped in Munich, and somebody asked me where I'd been. I have a suntan, or I did then. And somebody says, where were you? And this was in the hotel in Munich, and I guess they expected me to say I was skiing in the Alps, and I said, Nigeria. He said, Nigeria. I said, Nigeria. He says, Nigeria. Isn't that in the Middle East? I said, no, it's in Africa. Oh, Africa. Oh, yes, they remember that. That's where Rommel got his problems. So immediately, you know, that brings up all... So I realized that hardly anybody knows anything about the west coast of Africa, and I don't stand here before you as an expert. All I can say is that I was in Nigeria, I was in Ghana, and I saw things, I absorbed things, and what I saw and absorbed are mine, and being mine, undoubtedly, they're very prone to error. However, I will say this, that a lot of interesting things happened to me there, and things which have made me alter my thinking about a lot of things which have, from time to time, which have occurred to me, which I've heard discussed, and so on. And I realize that it just isn't black and white as far as the questions of political problems and so on are concerned. And, you know, one of the things that everybody seems to be interested about is the political situation in Nigeria. Well, I don't think anybody can really tell you about it. I really don't. I don't think that anyone going to Nigeria can come back and tell you really concretely what the political attitude of Nigeria is. Now, there is an official attitude, but what the official attitude is as opposed to what the attitude of 37 or 38 million people is, I think no one who really wants to be honest can say there is such a thing. In fact, I talked to a half a dozen people at different hours of the day and in different social strata, different social areas, to find out what they thought. And you just can't come right out and say to somebody, do you like America or do you like Russia? You know, you're going to get all kinds of idiotic answers. But I came out with this, that three or four people volunteered to me. Now, I was a little suspicious because they volunteered it. They said, everybody likes America. This is the way they said it. Everybody like America. Oh, everyone likes Americans. I thought, well, fine. Well, then, it wasn't more than 20 minutes later, I heard from other sources that a large percentage of the Nigerian population were inclined to be pro-Russian. Now, this was another source. Now, I know a lot of people are going to call up and be very angry, but I'm just telling you things I heard in Nigeria. And this was from a native. So argue with him, I don't know. But I did see some interesting things. One day, I'm sitting on the veranda of the Federal Palace Hotel. Now, the Federal Palace Hotel is a new hotel in Lagos. It's right on the bay, and it is truly an unbelievable hotel. You could not conceive of such a thing being in Africa. It is the most modern architecture. It's the kind of architecture you see, you know, when you see pictures of South American cities. You know, these very peculiar kind of buildings where they have a sort of a concrete waffle-like effect, grill-like effect, so that every room has a concrete patio, and it's all strange colors and mosaics and so forth, and it juts up into the sky and is surrounded by these magnificent royal palms. And it looks out over the bay, and directly in front of the Federal Palace Hotel, which has a huge veranda that goes all the way around it, a veranda where the sahib sits and sips his gin and tonic all afternoon and looks out while people are toting bars and lifting bales. And it's that kind of a place. Now, in the Federal Palace Hotel, it's the most expensive hotel, as far as I know, in all of Africa. People always are asking me about expenses. Is it expensive in Nigeria? Yes, which would surprise you. It is extremely expensive. As a matter of fact, roughly double for a hotel room in Nigeria what you'd pay here in New York for comparable quarters. And food isn't too expensive, but the hotel room, actual living room, is very expensive there and very difficult to get. They have few hotels, and they have plenty of business. So naturally, the prices have gone way up. Now, the Federal Palace Hotel is a new hotel, very expensive. It sits around, between $25 and $30 a day for a room. Double room, I think, runs a little more than that, but it's a magnificent hotel. Well, one day I'm sitting on the plaza there. I was supposed to meet someone. I'm sitting on the plaza. By the way, I did not stay at the Federal Palace. This kind of place makes me itch right away. It gives you a feeling as though somehow somebody has misplaced a large chunk of Miami Beach, and it has no business in Africa, you know? And it just makes you break out in hives. You expect any minute now a Bourse Circuit comic to start going to work up there, and Paul Anka is going to be singing there next week. You know, you get this feeling about the whole business. So I stay away, but this day I'm down there, and I'm waiting for someone, and I'm sitting out on the veranda, and the sun is rocking down, and I'm watching a freighter going back and forth in the bay, looking for an anchorage. This is another weird thing about Lagos. It seems like everywhere you look, boats are going just across the horizon, and they're really level with the horizon, you know. Almost all of that part of Nigeria is practically at sea level. Maybe it's 4 or 5 feet above sea level. It's low, swampy, sandy ground. And you can see these freighters, hundreds of freighters, going back and forth in the bay there, anchoring right out, right offside the front of the hotel. So I'm watching a freighter go back and forth. It was a Swedish ship, I believe. And I'm just sitting there calmly in the sun and waiting. And I had a drink, and I was just biding my time. And a guy walked up and leaned over the rail and was just obviously looking for somebody to talk to. That's one thing you begin to miss when you're traveling all over the world, is someone to talk to. You know, this is a real tough problem when you're a lone traveler. You look for things to read, and you look for people to talk to. Well, this guy is standing there, and he's got a camera around his neck, and there was something about him. I assumed he was a German, because there were many people from West Germany in that area. And when he started to talk to me, I immediately thought, well, he's German. He had a heavy accent, and it sounded like a German accent. And so we got talking, and we talked for, maybe 20 or 30 minutes. And he says, you know, I'm very lonely. I just checked into my hotel room upstairs, and I'm just going out of my head looking for someone to talk to. You have no idea how great it is to have someone just to sit and talk to. So I bought him a drink, and we started the talk. We went on and on and on. And the first thing that got me was that I have never heard a more complete expression of racial bias than this guy came out with the first 30 seconds of our talk. He just laid it right out on the line, you know? Well, I was taken aback, and especially by the terms that he used. His terms were far more virulent than any of the terms that I had ever heard anybody who I thought was racially biased. This was really wild. See, well, I thought, well, maybe this is the European way. I don't know. So I'm sitting there chewing the fat with him. We get talking back and forth about our cameras, of all things, and he says, I'll bet you've never seen this kind of a camera. And he takes his camera out. It was a 35-millimeter single-lens reflex, and he opens it up. He shoves it across to me, and I took a look at it. Tell him to write. I took a look at it, And I told him, no, I don't. After all these years, I have to tell you that. I told him, I've never seen such a camera. And I took a careful look at it, and it turns out to be a Polish camera. I had never seen a Polish 35-millimeter camera. So I said to him, well, where are you from? He says, Warsaw. Well, that put a whole new complexion on the thing, you see, because obviously here was a communist. Now, he was a real communist, not the kind that the John Birch Society is after. This is a real one, because you don't get out of Warsaw. You are not sent on missions all over the world unless you're really one of the boys. And so, you know, it put a whole completely different complexion on it. So we're sitting there, and I'm like, Warsaw? And there were so many things I wanted to ask him, but, you know, then you don't just come right out with them. So I continue to talk about the camera and about the birds and about the sky and about the drink. And finally I said, what do you do? And he says, I'm an engineer. Oh, what kind of an engineer are you? Oh, I work in heavy industry. Heavy industry. Well, that's no engineer. Come on, you know, I wanted to get, what kind of an engineer are you here? Well, it turns out that what he did was he was an expert in installation of heavy industrial equipment, like drill presses, enormous things, you know. But this is when we started to get down to the basic tacks. I said, well, how long are you going to be here? Because he was telling me that he had just been married. He was married 2 months, and he was very unhappy to be in Lagos. He had just come from Shanghai and Rangoon. Well, you know, this is a real operator. And I'm trying to find out how long he's going to be here. He says, well, he says, I might be here just a couple of days, and I might be here longer. Maybe for months, I don't know. Well, that's an interesting assignment. He had no idea how long he was going to be there. He might be there 2 days, he might be there months. Well, we started to walk down on the terrace and taking pictures. We took pictures for about a half an hour, and I was curious about this guy, what he did and where he had, you know, what he was about to do. Well, we must have talked for about a half an hour after that when he suddenly began to realize that he must have been saying things that he shouldn't have been saying. And from that minute on, it was like talking to a brick wall. He just wouldn't discuss anything that he was doing or why he was doing it. Now, this intrigued me, and so I went back to the hotel, and I was talking to people, friends of mine, who I knew all the situation in Africa, and I mentioned this Polish engineer, and they said, oh, well, they're all over the place. Polish and Czechoslovakian engineers are all over. So I began to do a little investigating into it, and I found that one of the things that's happening throughout most of the newer countries is that Czechoslovakia in particular is selling complete plants to these countries. In other words, let's say Nigeria wants a paint plant. Well, they'll sell them a complete paint plant. They will build it for them. They will design it for them. They will put it down on the ground. They will start it working. They will train the people to run it. And it's bought as a package deal. And a couple of days later, just this is a weird coincidence, there was an editorial in one of the newspapers, in one of the Nigerian papers, to the effect that Czechoslovakia is the... What's the matter, Jan? Troubles? That Czechoslovakia leads the world in industrial packaging. Leads the world. I had no idea. I didn't even know there was such an industry. That they build plants and sell them all over the world, just like we build Fords or we build Oldsmobiles. Yeah, they'll build any kind of a plant. And they will sell it to you for a flat fee. And they will put it up and they will get it running, and that's the end of it. Well, it turns out that they had sold all kinds of plants to Nigeria. All over the area, there are Czechoslovakian plants. Now, whether this is a political development, I don't know. I noticed some very interesting things in the newspapers. I noticed one thing, that Russia has offered the Nigerian people Russian planes for the Nigerian airline. They've also offered them money to get the airline started. Now, this is hitting at home. As I said last night, the new countries all look upon an airline as a real status symbol. If they can have one plane that says Transylvania Airlines on it, that lands in New York, and it's a jet plane and has four big jet engines, and lands at Idlewild, their company and their country is in. You know, that's even bigger than being in the UN. So they're hitting home. Now, this I know has happened there. As far as political feeling, I found everybody I met personally were extremely cordial to America and seemed to be very, very involved with us. They dug us. Although there was a wild editorial, just an absolutely screaming editorial in one of the newspapers about the third day I was there, about why is all this rotten American music on our radio station? We're saying this is a terrible, rotten stuff. And they went on and they listed all these American people who are on the Nigerian radio station. It's very weird, believe me, to hear a Hausa announcer introducing Elvis Presley. And, you know, they use all the disc jockey phrases, but it's very slightly out of focus. They'll say, okay, kids, here is one that I know you will all swing to. That very disjointed, and they bring it out. On comes Presley, belting it out, you know. And so this goes on, and they object to it, and yet at the same time, they dig it, you know. People are very interesting this way, that the thing you generally... hate the most, in a way, is the very thing that you will embrace. That a man, for example, the whole idea of Britain now is anathema to most of the Nigerians because they have their much vaunted freedom, and yet they emulate the British in almost everything they do. Their police force dresses like the British police force. Their system of government is a British system. They have British money. It's all shillings and pounds and tuppence. Everything is British. It's very British. In fact, the first thing that a young Nigerian wants to do is to go to Oxford, if he really is in the upper class. Oh, yes. They it's just like the Indians, you know. The Indians want to get away from the British, but they want to be more like the British than the British. And if you really want to see high tea served, go to New Delhi in some well-known Indian doctor's home. You'll really see it. But... speaking of education, a very odd thing happened to me. You never know when somebody's putting you on, but this is a little incident that occurred to me. I went down to a place where there were a group of natives that were fishing. Now, the way they fish in Nigeria, they have several ways of fishing. They don't use bait to begin with. They have a little silver hook that they trail in the water, and the hook itself is silver and makes a flashing light in the water, and the little fish hit it. Little tiny fish, about 3 inches long, and they whip them out as fast as they can throw the hook in. So they fill up a whole basket full of these little fish, and they fry them whole in palm oil. You know, speaking of palm oil, a weird thing happened to me one day. I was riding with a taxi driver. I had rented a car for the whole day with a cab driver. See, the cabs are not like here. You argue with the cab driver. You get in the cab and you say, how much to Federal Palace? And he says, 10 bob. You say, oh, come on. You slam the door and you walk 10 bob, you're an idiot. And then he backs up real quick. He backs up. He says, how much? Or you tell, how much, master? And you look at him and you say, look, Dad, the last time I went to the Federal Palace Hotel, it was 5 bob, and the guy was cheating me. Oh, he says, oh, come on. He puts it in the first. He starts to go. Then you say, now, wait a minute. 6 bob. It's 7. He says, I'm sorry. Yep, you start waving for another cab. He says, okay, master, 6 bob. And off you go. This is the way cabs work in this country. So everybody is on a bargaining basis, and they love it. I mean, if you don't bargain, they feel cheated because most of it is the bargaining. So I was in this cab, and by the way, the cab driver was a magnificent specimen. How would you like to ride in Little Hillman Minx? And it's got leather seats, you know. And the worst insult you can tell a cab driver there is to say, turn on the meter. See, they got meters in there. That means you don't trust his bargaining or anything. We're going to go strictly by the meter. And once in a while, you have to do it, you know, when you're having a real tough time with a guy. He'll turn the meter on. And then when the meter goes over the price that you had told him he was cheating you at, he just turns around and grins and doesn't say anything, keeps driving. But I think their meters are fixed. But nevertheless, I'm sitting in the cab, and this guy's a magnificent character. He has a dark red set of robes, enormous brocaded robes, and he's wearing these big brass bracelets, and he has a gold hat on, a little gold beanie that's all embossed with red thread. And he's sitting up there in the front driving the cab. You know, there's a very weird feeling with somebody like that is driving the cab. You really feel like it's a ritual. Really, you know? And incidentally, all cab drivers in this country drive almost exclusively with their horn blowing constantly. They don't even, the horn blows by itself, you know? They don't even press it. It just goes. So I'm sitting in the cab, and we're going all the way on out to this place where they were gonna fish. So we went out, we got down on the dock there, and there was a kid. Kid said to me, he looked up, and he says, you're from the United States? And I said, yeah. He says, have you ever been to Chicago? I said, Chicago, yeah, I was born there, I lived in Chicago. Yeah? He said, have you ever heard of Drexel Institute? Drexel Institute? I bet 97% of the people who are listening to me tonight never heard of Drexel Institute. I said, yeah, I know about Drexel Institute. What do you know about Drexel Institute? And here's this kid, and he's wearing nothing more than a loincloth. And he's asking me about Drexel Institute. It's a very weird feeling, you know. I don't know, what is it? Am I being put on or what? Is this his line or what is it, you know? Drexel Institute. Well, I'll tell you what Drexel Institute is, in case you don't know about it. It's an engineering school in Chicago, and a very good one. And it's strictly engineering. So I said, what about Drexel Institute? He says, my father is going to send me to Drexel Institute. Why Drexel Institute? He says, well, I want to be an engineer, and I read about Drexel Institute in a magazine. Snow and ice is a theoretical thing, you know. So the idea of snow and ice was very great to him. So we sat and talked around there for about 10 minutes about Drexel Institute, and I got back in the car, and I couldn't figure out whether he was telling me the truth, whether he wanted to give me money, or, you know, me to give him money, or whether this is just a thing he told Americans when they talked to him. I couldn't make that decision there, but it seemed to be real. But then on the other hand, there was something about it that was unreal. So we're driving along, and I said to the cab driver, I said, what about that kid? And he grinned, and he says, the one that's going to Drexel Institute? And I said, yeah. And I wish I could imitate their dialogue, their accent. I can't. Speaking of accent, Ed, do you have that record on the first one? Ed, look on the one that says nylon. Is it nylon? Okay. Well, here is a good example of, yeah, the first one I gave you. Okay, we'll put it on there. The one where the guy sings in pidgin English, which is a very, very good example of the kind of accent that you hear everybody speaking there throughout Nigeria. Now, the reason I want to bring this out is because everybody in Nigeria is taught to speak English. It's the only language by which all the natives can communicate, since, as we've said before, they have so many different languages. Here's an example of the accent that is spoken around Lagos. Most of the people who live in the Lagos area are Yoruba, as far as their tribal affiliation is concerned, which gives them their accent. The Hausa speaks with a different accent. The Igbo speak with a different accent. This is a Yoruba-speaking man who is speaking English. Oddly enough, you'll notice, too, in this song, there is an interesting piece of irony. He is singing about a nylon dress. However, the thing that's important, I've already done it. Yeah, I did it once, yeah. The thing that's important is that nylon is impossible in the tropics. Nobody wears nylon because nylon is very itchy in the tropics. Now hold it, just a minute. Don't stop it, Eddie. Just leave it go. This is a typical example of high life singing that you hear just coming out of every loudspeaker, every radio set, every TV set, all throughout the breadth of West Africa.
You want to make your baby happy, go to shop and get a dozen of nylon. She with no nobody but you alone. Nylon is good for her. Nylon dress is a lovely dress. Nylon dress is a fancy dress. If you want to make your baby happy, nylon is good for her.
You know, coming back from all this, I came away with a peculiar bittersweet taste in my mouth that is, I suppose, connected with the fact, you know, wherever you go as a traveler, I've traveled throughout most of Europe, throughout the Middle East, and as far east as India at one time or another. And I found that no matter where I go, I have gone in the past, there is a common base. In other words, if you go to Sweden, even though you don't speak Swedish, the people live the same way you do. You know, you can understand them. If you go to Denmark, it's the same way. If you go to France or Spain, it's roughly the same. There are little differences, but you know the foundation is the same. And so you can make contact, real contact with people. It really is almost exclusively a matter of language. But in Africa, there is something there that is impenetrable. Now, you may think you're penetrating it. You may think that you're making headway. You may think that you are making contact with people. But when you get away from it, you have the sense that you haven't really gotten through. You haven't really understood it. Do you know what I'm getting at? It's disconcerting, too. A friend of mine is another traveler type. I'll tell you who it is, Shel Silverstein, who's traveled all over the world. And Shel one time told me a thing before I'd ever really traveled in Equatorial Africa. He said, you know, you ought to see Africa. He says, I you have to see it. You have to experience it. But nobody can tell you about it. And he said, and furthermore, when you get out of Africa, you will feel not so much like you have left Africa. You'll feel like you've escaped. And that's a big difference. Well, I didn't quite understand what he meant by this. And now I do. I do know that there is a feeling. And again, as I say, this friend of mine who does travel a great deal, he has the same sensation that wherever you go, you can somehow make a group of friends. You can somehow establish rapport with people. But you just can't in Africa. There is a thing that drops down. There is a great grill or some kind of a fence that just comes down between you. And the last couple of days, thinking about this experience, it's been the kind of experience that you can't say is a good one or a bad one. It's a baffling experience. It had a lot of great moments, and it had a lot of moments that were not so great. And yet, on the other hand, overall, the whole experience is one of a peculiar kind of flavor that you don't know whether is a good taste or a bad taste, and you don't know whether it's going to hurt you or whether it's going to be good for you. And as you taste it, you have a vague suspicion that whatever it is habit-forming and can somehow do you harm. Do you follow me there, what I'm saying about this place? And almost everybody I've ever talked to who knows Africa very well has said that up to a point. Now, when you say Africa, I'm talking about Equatorial Africa, and in particular the West Coast, which is part of the world that hardly anybody seems to know much about these days, and yet is one of the swingingest parts. Funny thing was said to me about this part of the world by a young man who I know who is an executive over there, has been there 7 years in a very good capacity. He said the first thing that happens to you not really the first thing, but the thing that begins to bore itself into you after a certain length of time is an almost palpable sense of loneliness. A tremendous, boring, gnawing, devouring loneliness. He said, there are a lot of Europeans around here, but even they are lonely within that framework. It's like being marooned on a desert island. And he says, and I have a lot of friends. I can't understand it. He said, but there it is. And he said, year after year, it gets worse. And he said, I'll tell you one thing. We were sitting having dinner in a place called Antoine's, which is on Broad Street, right down through the middle of Lagos. He says, if I don't get out in the next year, I know that I'll never be able to leave. I said, well, what do you mean you'll never be able to leave? He said, well, it's just that way. He said, guys who are here too long can't go because they can no longer get back into life. He says, it's just like that. He says, I had a lot of trouble myself. He said, I had a vacation last year, and I went back to Germany. And he said, I was like a fish out of water for about a month till I came back here. And he said, it's a sickness. He says, it's really got me. Now, I said, well, what is it that's got you? So I don't know. So I can't explain it. I just don't know what it is. And then he said, you know, there's another thing. There's women trouble here. I said, what do you mean women trouble? He said, well, there are no European women to speak of at all. He said, I'll go for months without even a date. He says, you know, every night, how long can you spend, you know, coming back to the club and drinking gin and tonic till you go to bed? He says, and then once in a while you read an old magazine. He said, I haven't had a date in a month. He says, and any date that I have is some girl's coming through here for 2 weeks on a tour. He says, and that's about the end of it. And I says, well, what about, you know, girls around here? So, oh boy, that's dangerous. Meaning, you know, there's danger involved in that. And so he had a wild look in the eye. And up to this point, you know, I thought, gee, this guy's really made it. He's got the big house with the patio, you know, the company's provided him with servants and the whole business. He's got this big sports car, and he lives up on the hill, and you know, the whole bit. And he's got a wild look in the eye. And then here's the surprising thing. you know, it's like telling stories out of school. But I went to the Lido one night, which is the local nightclub. Well, this is a real swinging place, and it's an open-air place. It's not a nightclub like we have. It's in one way, it's far more sensual than any nightclub you ever saw. And on the other hand, it's far more Victorian. Sensuality can be so pure that there is nothing wrong associated with it. Are you aware of that? In its raw state, sensuality is pure. You understand me, madam? No. Well, anyway, that's the kind of thing it was. And I'm sitting there at the table drinking Nigerian beer. Nigerian beer is the only beer that I've ever had that has fur on it. Let me tell you, boy, this is fighting beer. It fist fights all the way down. And for 20 minutes later, you can feel it kicking and struggling. And it's real beer, and it comes in a great big thing, you know, a big jug, and it's called Star Beer, Nigerian beer. Well, I'm sitting there drinking Nigerian beer when I noticed the entire crew, this is the thing that got me, the entire crew of an office in town. Now, these guys were the Lagos representatives of a very official organization that is world-renowned for its efficiency. And it's absolute efficiency. And you should have seen these guys. There's four guys over there, the managing director, his assistant, the sales manager, and his assistant, and they are pie-eyed. They're sitting there, they're hollering, they're knocking over the glasses. All four of them, you know, and it's Saturday night, and it's wild. And I look, and I know these guys, and I know these guys are official guys. Now, you haven't heard the end of the story. I am with their boss, who has just arrived on the plane from Germany today, you see, to Lagos. And I'm sitting there with the boss, and this guy is the real, you know, he's the real boss. And he looks over there, and he sees his crew. They kept falling under the table. You know, one would get up, and the other one would slide under. And so he looks over there. He says, is that Herr Aschenschlager? He says to me, and I says, it is indeed. He says, whoop, there he goes again. And we're watching. And you know, it was getting hotter and hotter, and the dance was going on, and the music was playing, and it was like I was in a terrible scene out of a Humphrey Bogart movie, you see. And the next thing I know, the sales manager is weaving his way over towards us, and he reaches down, and he grabs the boss, you see, and obviously jungle rot has affected the rear part of this guy's brain. He grabs the boss by the tie, and he says, how are you, you old? There are two blanks there, which I have just taken out. How are you? How is everything back there in Cologne? And he pushes him back in his seat and knocks the beer over in his lap and goes reading back to his table. Well, all I can say is that for 3 hours later that night in the hotel, I could hear reports being written out in the next room. It was a terrible moment. Well, I know these guys are not that kind of guy. You know, they all have that very official look. It's like if you took the most official Madison Avenue guy you know, I mean, who never gives up, you give him 2 years in Lagos and his eyes start looking in two different directions simultaneously, believe me. and I had this terrible feeling, you know, that I was seeing something out of, truly, seeing something either out of Somerset Maugham or Joseph Conrad. You remember some of those tales of jungle rot out of Conrad? Those great stories of guys going slowly downhill until finally you could barely see them above the bay. They're rowing their dugout canoe in the heat, and Tondaleas at the other end of the canoe, you know, and they're drinking stuff out of a gourd, you know, oh, the whole thing. So the next morning, this was the aftermath of it. The next morning, I go to the office of these guys, you know, and this is the kind of an outfit that opens at 8 a.m. sharp. I go there at the next day. And there isn't anybody in the office except one native who's sitting there on the telephone. And I come in and I say, where is everybody? He says, I don't know, sir. I knew. They were all sitting around with ice packs on their heads. Well, the next day, I was talking to my friend from the other outfit, and I says, you know, what about this? He says, oh, it happens to all of us. His wild look. And one of the funny little incidents that I had happen to me one day was I was in the line in the post office, and I was buying Nigerian stamps and everything, and there was a guy behind me, and he was dressed in Western clothes. And I said to the clerk, I said, I want 7 Nigerian international airmail stamps, and so he, for regular letter weight. And she said, all right. So he started to give me it. I couldn't find the place to mail the letter. I'm in the post office, you know. We're used to the slots, see. So I'm looking around, looking for the place, and I says, any place, where do you mail this? Well, before he could answer, the guy behind me says, oh, boy, Dad, he says, nothing works like home here. He says, they got a box out in front there. Well, I turned around, and this guy is behind me. And it's an American. And he was a Negro. And so we went out, and he says, can I give you a lift anywhere? And I said, sure, fine. It turns out he's a listener, by the way. He was astounded to find me in a post office in Nigeria. The guy's from Brooklyn. So we get in the car. Yeah, we get in the car, and he has a little console. And he works for an American film company. Then we started to talk about Nigeria. And he says, boy, he said, you know, he said, I'll tell you, he said, when I first came here, I thought I understood everybody. He said, I've been here now 6 months. He says, and every day now, I realize more and more that I understand less and less about the people, the place, the way they think, the whole business. I said, well, gee, you know, you shouldn't have any trouble. He said, let me tell you, boy. He says, I really discovered how American I am here. He says, I really discovered that I am really an American. I said, you know, this is an interesting thing coming from you. You know, you're realizing the situation. He says, let me tell you. He says, I got friends back in the States. He says, I would love to have about 20 of my friends here who think they know all about this and bring them here for about 6 months. He says, they would realize then just exactly what they are, and they would know their own true identity. And so we rode around town a little bit, and he's looking out, and he's sort of laughing. And I'm laughing, and finally he says, well, he says, gee, I never figured I'd see you here in Nigeria. I says, no, well, I didn't either, Dad. And I got out in front of Kingsway, and he drove away, and I sat around, and that was the end of that. But the thing is, you really realize how Western you are in a place like Nigeria, Ghana. You also realize that the beliefs that Americans have, that any problem can be solved. You know, Americans really believe that problems can be solved. They will not concede that there is an insoluble problem of any kind. You know, nothing is really insoluble in the affairs of men. Wow. Boy, I mean, you stick around this place about 20 minutes and you begin to feel that not only is it the communication just doesn't exist, not really. On a very basic human level, yeah. Like my friend from Brooklyn said, man, you really know that you're an American. You really know it. And he says, they don't know from an American. They don't understand us either. I suppose we are the mysterious Occidental.